Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll start with analysis of the week gone by, work our way through a couple of news spots, and then end with cavemen and the economy. It's true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 14th of June. Glad you could be with us, everybody. Coming up in the second half of the show today, the last installment of Consumed, our series on the consumer economy and us. Believe me when I tell you, you're going to want to hear this one, all right? But first, you know where we are, calendar-wise. Don't you? Right on the cusp of that summertime lull where the news goes to die. Schools are out, vacations have started, you know what I'm talking about. Still in all, there were some going-ons this week worth spending the next 4 minutes of live radio on. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rampell from the New York Times. She is down in our Washington bureau today. John Carney from CNBC. He is in our studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hi, hey, Kai.
So, Mr. Carney, let me start with you and something that's been happening, you know, somewhat regularly over the past couple of weeks. The 10-year T-note is getting more interest rate worthy, right? The 10-year's up above 2%. Rates are rising overall. Do you make anything of that or don't you?
I do make something of it, although I make two things of it, and they're contradictory.
Of course
they are,
John.
Some people worry that the positive signs we've seen in the economy means that the Fed is going to pull back on some of it, on its low rate policies, mm-hmm. maybe QE. And so rates are rising ahead of that. Or it might mean that the economy actually is doing better and people are putting money to work in places yeah. other than the treasuries. So that's a good sign.
Okay. But Catherine, help me out with this because, you know, rising rates are tricky and people get worried and the stock market's going a little crazy. I saw the word volatility today for the first time in I don't know how long. Right?
Yeah, I mean, the economy is still not in great shape, as we discuss every time I'm on the show.
I know. Maybe it's you. Have you ever thought of that?
Maybe I'm bringing down the whole economy. It's possible. So, you know, I think there's still reason to be concerned about where the economy is headed because of a lot of different factors, including, you know, what's happening to government budgets and uncertainty about Europe and various other things. So it's not terribly surprising that we're still seeing some concerns, you know, reflected in markets. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the Fed issue is a major one for at least a lot of the analysts that I talk with. There is some concern that, as John mentioned, that maybe the Fed will start to at least announce a plan mm-hmm. to tighten.
Or announce a plan to have a plan to perhaps eventually start talking about having
yeah,
a plan,
that's,
I mean,
that's sort of more what it would look like. Yeah. And a lot of people don't actually think that that's going to happen next week just because too many of the economic indicators that have come in recently mm-hmm. have been a little disappointing. So it doesn't seem like there are grounds necessarily for the Fed to make waves by saying, okay, guys, here's our plan for a plan for a plan yeah. to tighten, which would indeed make waves, even though it doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. John, changing gears here for a second. The big story of the past 10 days, of course, has been the NSA and Edward Snowden and Prism and the companies involved in that. Do you foresee peril for any of these companies going forth? I mean, they are now being mentioned. We're going to have a story on it actually later in the broadcast. Do you think they're worried or are they just going to weather this storm as they
I think
so
they'll
many?
Weather this storm. I don't think that there's a lot of trouble either coming from the telecom companies or Booz Allen, the company that Snowden worked for as a contractor mm-hmm. to the government. I don't think they're in a lot of trouble. But one of the things I think that was amazing that we found out is just how much money these private contractors make. And I think there may be some reconsideration in the not anytime very soon, but perhaps in the next presidential election. People say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be sort of outsourcing so much of this work.
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, they could be in trouble.
Yeah. Interesting point, actually, about the politics of that getting caught up in the machinations of things. And Catherine, this next one's a little sideways, but I want to talk briefly on Syria. It's yet another thing that's going to take the president And let him not concentrate on the economy and jobs and all of that stuff and sort conceivably gum up the works in Washington. You worried about Syria at all, seeing as how you're sitting in Washington this week?
I mean, to be fair, I'm an economics reporter.
You are no expert.
I'm not an expert in this
disclaimer
area.
Warranted.
Yes. So I feel like I'm out of my element a bit.
Go ahead, John. You're not an expert.
Okay, look, I'm never out of my element. Here's my feeling, that the big danger, actually, disruptions in the Middle East tend to drive oil prices higher. That acts as a drag on the economy. We're already seeing a little of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, traders who trade in commodities tell CNBC that they are watching what's happening in Syria, you know, all the time, and they're heavily focused on it. So there is an economic drag that we could see out of that.
All right, there you go. John Carney from CNBC, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks,
you
Kyle.
Too.
All right, we'll see you. On Wall Street today, who knows what those people are thinking? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This next item is going to be one of those where if you haven't heard it before, you're going to be like, no, come on, really? Seriously? So here we go. You know Happy Birthday, the song? All right, that's not actually a question. It's probably sung like 311 gazillion times a year just in this country alone. It's been translated into Navajo and Maori. But it turns out there is some disagreement about its copyright. A filmmaker in New York City named Jennifer Nelson wants to use it in her documentary about that song's history. And it turns out she has to pay a licensing fee to one of those media conglomerates that owns song copyrights. Well, in a lawsuit filed yesterday, Nelson claims the song is actually derived from a popular tune of the late 1800s and so should be in the public domain. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman brings us up to speed.
When I told a friend I was doing this story, she said, "No one owns that song. Toddlers own it." Parents who have put up their happy birthday videos on YouTube maybe aren't going to be hit up by Warner Music for copyright, but someone with a fancy camera, well, there's royalties to be made, says attorney Mark Rifkin. He represents filmmaker Jennifer Nelson.
For a small documentary film producer, I think $1,500 isn't a lot of money. She wants to see that the song is given back to the public.
Rifkin argues the song doesn't belong to Warner Music.
There was a song that was written in the 1890s called Good Morning to All. It's the same melody.
Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm.
Exactly. Then the public just simply began to sing Happy Birthday to You.
Kind of like early 20th century crowdsourcing.
There certainly could be copyright on new lyrics plus an old melody.
Robert Brownice at George Washington University Law School says there's just no evidence that happened here. Warner Music declined to comment. Brownice estimates Warner makes about $2 million a year licensing public performances of the birthday song. They could make more, except...
There are some chain restaurants that have written their own birthday songs precisely to avoid having to pay.
Other copyrighted birthday songs are off the menu too, of course, like Stevie Wonder's and the Beatles. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a new term making the rounds in Silicon Valley, calling a company a prism company, as in Facebook and Google, Yahoo, and a handful of other big tech firms that were named in those leaked NSA documents that Carney and Catherine and I were talking about. It is not exactly the type of morale booster being called a prism company that most firms are looking for, as Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
There's a lot of suspicion in Silicon Valley these days. Employees at the so-called prism companies are clearly on lockdown. After the news broke, I staked out a Google shuttle bus stop in Berkeley. I asked about a dozen Googlers, what's the mood like in the office?
Unfortunately, I'm not able to comment.
Sorry.
Oh, I don't think I'm supposed to say anything about that stuff.
After striking out with the Googlers, I headed to San Francisco's startup district and found Ben Nelson standing in a long line in front of Sushi Rito, a takeout joint that sells sushi burritos. Nelson is 24 and an engineering intern at Europe, and he wasn't too upset about the whole thing.
It would be a bigger issue, I think, if we had gone from perfect privacy to imperfect privacy.
Nelson says we already know that Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft are tracking almost everything we do online. Now, we know the government is grabbing some of that data, too.
Since it's just like another kind of domino, then people are going to care less.
At the co-working site Rocket Space, I met Zach Goldberg. About 130 startups share offices here. Turns out Goldberg is an ex-Googler. And like a lot of techies I spoke to, he doesn't really trust the media.
I would just hope that this doesn't get too much publicity based on FUD.
What does FUD mean?
Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's a tactic that's used to get people overexcited about something or perhaps overly scared of than perhaps they should be.
Goldberg says early press reports suggested that the NSA had a backdoor to the tech company's data servers and could take whatever it wanted.
There's a lot of sensational headlines, and I don't think there's a clear story that's out there quite yet.
But now the tech companies are trying to take control of that story. Google, Facebook, and Yahoo asked to be released from their gag orders so they could talk about Prism. Sina Kanifer is a tech entrepreneur and privacy activist. He says most of the tech community thinks Silicon Valley is taking the fall for the government. At the same time, some developers are worried that the Valley is losing its independent spirit.
Why did we not see someone from one of these companies who's committed to privacy leak this?
Annie wonders if the Valley has become a little too comfortable with invading our privacy. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
British Prime Minister David Cameron hosts the G8 meeting next week, and as the host, he gets to decide, at least technically, what the agenda is going to be. Cameron has put tax dodging right at the top, which is curious because he can't really take the moral high ground here. 10 of the world's top tax havens are British overseas territories, many of them in the Caribbean, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Sun-kissed, palm-fringed, and shady. To clean up its image, the British Virgin Islands commissioned this rousing national song.
Out of the huts of history's pains, our ancestors bled and died.
But critics of the tiny British-owned archipelago in the Caribbean say it needs much more than a musical makeover. John Christensen is an anti-tax evasion campaigner.
Time and time again, when I'm trying to track illicit funds, embezzled funds out of Africa, out of Egypt, say, or Algeria, a British Virgin Island company has been involved.
The islands are home to more than 800,000. That's registered companies. There's only 27,000 people living there. The BVI is reckoned to be one of the world's most attractive destinations for tax evaders, although it's facing some stiff competition.
Surrounded by the crystal clear waters of the Western Caribbean, the Cayman Islands are a myriad of natural beauty.
The Caymans, Turks and Caicos, Bermuda, Anguilla and Montserrat all vie with each other as financial centres, offering secrecy and low or no taxation. They're all self-governing British territories, says Christensen, relics of the British Empire that still serve Britain's purposes.
You have to look at these British tax havens as essentially conduits for capital flowing out of, you know, Latin America, out of North America, out of Africa and Asia, through these tax havens en route to London. And London is the ultimate destination.
Which, he says, is why the Brits encourage the tax havens to flourish. But Emma Seary of the Oxfam aid agency claims there's been a big shift in British public opinion.
People are sick and tired of suffering austerity here in this country, whilst others prosper by hiding their money offshore or fiddling the books.
Oxfam estimates that British tax havens are harbouring more than $6 trillion, some of it dodging tax in Europe, the US and Asia, and some of it plundered from Africa by corrupt politicians.
This is hundreds of billions that could be invested in teachers and doctors and nurses in poor countries, and it's being taken out of their economies and they can't get it back.
Under pressure from his own voters and from other cash-strapped governments, UK Prime Minister David Cameron has declared that the British tax havens should come clean.
The UK has to use its clout and match the rhetoric with action and force them to open up.
Robert Palmer of Global Witness says Cameron can compel Britain's tax havens to become more transparent. He has the power. But if he uses it, London's financial centre may suffer, and the havens may face a not-so-sunny future. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, the economy and biology.
Capitalism inflames insatiability through advertising, through marketing, this endless kindling of new needs.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow ended the week with another loss, gang. Dropped 105.7%, closed at 15,070. The NASDAQ off 21.6%, finished at 34.23. The S&P 500 gave up 9 points, about a half percent, finished at 16.26. For the week, the Dow lost 1.2%. The NASDAQ off 1.3%. The S&P 500 gave back 1%. Did you ever buy concert tickets on StubHub because Ticketmaster was sold out in like 2 minutes? Well, that company is part of eBay, which was off a third of 1%. Going to one of the big theme parks this summer, dreading the lines. Universal Studios in Hollywood suggests you cut the line with its front-of-the-line pass, $169, compared with $84 for the regular stand-in-line pass. Universal Studios is part of Comcast, by the way, which was flat. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market.
We go together like rum-a-lum-a-lum-a-lum-a-ding-a-ding-a-dong. Remember forever as she walks you wada-wada, yippity-boom-de-boom.
And you'll be whipped after singing your guts out all weekend for the 35th anniversary of the film release of Grease.
Wow!
I'm Michelle Phillippe with the Marketplace Singers.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have come on this Friday to the close of Consumed. The series our sustainability desk has been running this week.
We want more. We want more.
Here's how to order.
Now, how much would you pay?
But you can see it's worth it.
Call now because you're worth it, worth it, worth it.
The premise on the face of it was pretty simple. If you start thinking long term, not about today or tomorrow, not about running errands on a weekend, not about picking up a new pair of running shoes or a new grill at the hardware store, but long term, then how much longer can our economy keep working this way, where so many people just go ahead and buy what they want when they want it? What do we get for all that buying that we do, and what does it cost us? It's crazy hard to figure out, really, because the economy doesn't actually work right without us. How many times have you heard me say how important consumer spending is to economic growth? So, to wrap things up today, we figured we owed you an answer to the underlying question. Can we afford our consumer economy? The answer, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill and David Weinberg are about to tell us, is yes. But
since the dawn of man, we've basically always wanted more.
We're going to introduce you. So we've got two cavemen, actually. There's Ig.
And Ook.
And Ook. And Ig, it turns out, is a super great hunter-gatherer.
Yeah, his cave is full of stuff.
There's meat everywhere.
Yeah.
Ook? No.
No, not so
He's
much.
He's kind of, you know, he just didn't gather as much as Ig. He kind of loafed.
Yeah, good. Okay.
And here's what happens. You know how this is going to go. Ig lived. Ig had a ton to eat.
Ooh! Ook, he did not survive the winter.
He died. And so all of us, we're likely the descendants of Ig. At least that's what scientists think. We're descendants of the caveman who was really good at getting all that caveman stuff.
And you can see that today in that we have this internal desire for more.
The ancient philosophers knew of insatiability, you know, the myth of Midas, the man who wants to turn everything into gold. That's clearly about insatiability.
So that's Edward Skidelsky. He's the author of a book, How Much is Enough?
And that insatiability that he was talking about, another way to think about it is that's our inner Ig.
But this inner Ig is all amped up, Skidelsky says.
It's on steroids.
What's happened under capitalism is that the old restraints on insatiability have all been lifted, the old moral restraints. So capitalism inflames insatiability through advertising, through marketing, this endless kindling of new needs.
But there's something else that drives us, and that's each other. Like, I'm driven by my neighbor. David, I'm driven by you, by everyone around me.
So you want things not because you need them in any absolute sense, but because other people have them or other people don't have them.
And we see this in the rise of McMansions, in SAT tutors. But we also see this everywhere in life.
And we wanted to know, what are the costs of all this buying and lusting for more? So we flew to Boston to talk to Harvard professor Michael Sandel. He wrote a book called What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And it's all about how we've gone from having a market economy to being a market society where everything is for sale. And on our way, we decided to take advantage of the way that the market works, of what you can buy when everything is for sale. Take, for example, something that's familiar to all of us, cutting lines.
Yeah, we wanted to have two different experiences at the airport. So David got to buy all the upgrades, and I flew on a regular old ticket. The first big difference was the security line.
David's just skipped this entire line.
It wasn't a velvet rope, but it was a rope that was opened up for me. I breezed through security. Meanwhile,
I watched David breeze through security as I twisted around in a snaking queue and tried to wave at David.
But I couldn't see her. I was already through security. And while she was twisting through that line, I was done. So I went and I ordered some coffee.
Can I get a double espresso and a tall Americano?
He bought me coffee, which was sweet because then he went to his fancy lounge.
Right. So then I got to go into the Premier Club, which was this nice room with wood panel walls and dark lighting. And, oh, free coffee, it turns out. It was kind of like the lobby of a hotel.
And I took my coffee to a gate that was so packed with people, I couldn't sit down. So once we got to Boston, we asked Sandel what he thought about all of this.
And he says that buying a better seat or paying to board the plane earlier, like I did, there's nothing wrong with that.
That's a convenience. That's a service that the airlines should be free to sell. But what about quicker access to the security line?
Sandel says that's the real problem.
Because that, after all, is not a service. That's not a consumer service exactly. That line, the security check, is for the sake of the common good. It's really for the sake of the security of everyone flying. And for that matter, it's for the sake of national security. And so maybe there is a stronger civic case against letting money decide David's quicker access to the security line.
This is just one example, and it's not a big one. It's one most of us are familiar with, of the way we live in a market society.
Take another example, America's favorite pastime, baseball. This is a great place to see the market at work.
Mr. Red Sox, pin it, win it. Get today's program. $3. $3.
$2 programs. Get him right here. Get him right here.
And so that's exactly what we did. We took Sandel to a Red Sox game.
He points out all sorts of ways money has changed the game. And one of them is the way corporate sponsorship has worked its way into the very language of baseball.
When a player slides safely into a base, there's a promotion now with an insurance company, New York Life, where the announcer has to say, "Safe at home, safe and secure, New York Life."
And at first, these kinds of things are just irritating.
But the accumulated effect is that even the very language of the game, which has historically had a kind of lyrical quality with the best announcers, now the lyrical quality of the broadcast is diminished.
And what do we lose when that happens?
What we lose is a kind of direct, unfiltered relationship to the game, to the sounds of the game, to the rhythm of it. And it becomes yet one more part of life that's invaded and dominated by commercial values.
He says we've lost a relationship to something else, too. Basically, to each other. One of the consequences of living in a market society, says Sandel, is that we just don't hang out with each other the way we used to.
It's what Sandel calls the skyboxification of American life. And to tell the story, we actually snuck into a luxury skybox at Fenway Park.
With a Harvard professor. We snuck in.
We have a great perch behind glass. It's air conditioned in here. If the rain starts up again, we won't get wet.
We did this for a very specific reason. Sandel worries that the wealthy in our modern society can lead very separate lives.
It's no longer true that everyone stands in the same long lines for the restroom. No longer the case that everyone eats the same pretty inadequate food. And it's no longer true that when it rains,
Everyone gets wet.
This wouldn't really matter all that much if we were just talking about baseball games and airports. But Sandel says when you add up all these examples, not to mention things like better access to healthcare and education, it creates a problem for us.
Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but it does require that men and women from different backgrounds, different walks of life, encounter one another, bump up against one another in the ordinary course of life. Because this is what gives us a sense that we are all in this together. It gives us a sense of being engaged in a common project. And without that background experience of a shared civic life, it's very difficult to think and act as democratic citizens.
Sandel thinks we should at least talk about these choices.
How we decide what and how much to consume.
And whether we should even have these choices.
Because even if we can sustain this consumption in the short run, it's not without costs. I'm Adrian Hill.
I'm David Weinberg.
For Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Our series, Consumed, was produced by Mary Dew and Susan Davis. George Judson runs the Sustainability Desk. He edited the series as well. Kim Bowie, Matt Berger, Paul Brent, and Abhishek Taneha produced the web elements for us. If you missed part of the series this week, or if you just want to hear how all the stories fit together, which you ought to because they're kind of good, we put it into a special podcast. You can hear it right now on iTunes. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Today, the Dow off 105.7%, the NASDAQ off 21.6%. The S&P 500 down 9.6% there as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. This is APM.